Thanks, Gene, and thanks to you and Carol for inviting me. I'm really honored to be here to help celebrate the profound influence of Darwin and evolutionary thinking on our field, and really sort of the profound importance of evolutionary biology across all of biology and the influence of Darwin on all of our lives. I am Associate Director for Education and Outreach at the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center, as well as being an entomologist at NC State University. And I'm just have a captive audience here. I want you to know about the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center. It's a NSF-funded cooperative center between Duke, UNC, and NC State, and it really exists to promote synthetic research in evolutionary biology and education of evolutionary biology. And it's all about the science. So if you want a place to do your sabbatical and write a book and be surrounded by evolutionary biology and young thinkers in evolutionary biology, it's a great place to go. Go to our website and check it out. There's money for postdocs. There's especially really important emphasis on bringing together working groups of individuals who want to integrate their fields with the central focus of improving our understanding of evolutionary biology across all the fields and disciplines of biology. So that's my soapbox, and I'll go on. Like most of you, I have a quote from The Origin, and The Origin is a really great book in that it was a really empirical book, a theoretical book, and often a very poetic and well-written and easily accessible book. Here, Darwin says, "The affinities of all beings of the same class have sometimes been represented by a great tree. As buds give rise by growth to fresh buds, and these, if vigorous, branch out and overtop on all sides many a feebler branch. So by generation, I believe it has been with the great tree of life, which fills with its dead and broken branches the crust of the earth and covers the surface with its ever-branching and beautiful ramifications." Now that is a metaphor that I don't have to make up myself for descent with modification and Darwin's influence on all of our current sort of practice in evolutionary biology, especially systematics. Now, the great tree of life didn't originate with Darwin, that idea of the tree of life, sort of using the idea of a tree and its branching and its the harvest of its great bounty is probably an idea that goes back to antiquity. And Alfred Russel Wallace, in his paper on the law which has regulated the introduction of new species, one of those papers that got Darwin pushed Darwin to hurry toward his writing, sort of worried Darwin that there was someone out in Southeast Asia coming up with the same general idea. And Darwin, in his correspondence, wrote, he uses my simile. So Darwin felt, I guess, probably a bit jealous that Russel Wallace had also sort of come up with the tree of life as a great metaphor for an actual process in nature. Well, it's this tree of life actually predates this letter of Wallace, and I got this date wrong, so I apologize. It really suggests that one should be careful about historic research on blogs today. This was Darwin's Cartesian moment, where he wrote in the transmutation notebooks, "I think," and then sketched a tree of life with bifurcating or branching diagram of species relationships. And in this talk today, I'm really going to lay out for you the paradigm of using trees to organize our thinking and our hypothesis tests in evolutionary biology, and hopefully impress you with the sort of really broad scope of the use of trees in contemporary entomological research, and hopefully have some time to tell you about what one of our grand challenges is right now, and that's seeing the forest, because as we expand phylogenetic work, visualizing, interpreting, and disseminating trees has become a very, very difficult but very important thing. So I know there are a lot of groans in every audience of every talk that one realizes you're going to see hundreds of phylogenetic trees and their interpretation on the screen, but it's hard to overstate the importance of phylogenetic trees in entomological research and research across biology now. This paper, recently published in Science by Marty Condon and Sonia Scheffer, shows how one can discover unknown diversity, reveal an incredible number of species of this phytophagous fly, Blepharonura, a tephritid, across tropical rainforests, and infer from the genetic variation found and displayed in these phylogenetic trees just how many species must be in tropical ecosystems and in ecosystems that are understudied around the world. It's really amazing, and this is a good illustration of how phylogenetics is still illuminating the world around us. Now, Darwin and Wallace were among, if not the preeminent, empirical natural historians of their day, right? And so we've seen many examples today about how the complexity and wonder of the natural world really led them to want to explain it. And I think what makes them unique, right, is that they saw this natural diversity, and instead of seeing simply its beauty, they saw pattern in it. They wanted to explain basically the variation that they saw and the organizational pattern that they saw in it. And that may be because they were among the most widely traveled natural historians of their day. The evidence base from which they had to draw really came from their access to the tropics and to island habitats and unique places on the planet. Back to one of these trees by Condon et al. I mean, so here what we see, right, is a great diversity of fly species and a tree of life, a phylogenetic tree that's used as an organizing principle for understanding many, many things about these species, not just their relationships, but the host plants that they feed on, the number of species that there are, where the host shifts occurred and when, and how they use different parts of the plant. So, with that, I'd like to digress a little bit to sort of explain to you the paradigm of phylogenetic trees. And this is a very, very useful set of teaching tools from the Tree of Life Web Project from the University of Arizona and Dave and Wayne Madison. And I encourage you to go to the Tree of Life Web Project website if you're a teacher. This is an extremely useful way to introduce phylogenetic trees and really the underlying reality of the model that we use for descent with modification. So if you imagine one of Dave Madison's Bembidian carabids here, he calls it Mimi. We can see sort of the interconnected relationships of Mimi back through its parents and its siblings, following then on to several generations of Mimi and her half-siblings, basically through connections of parentage into the population level. And so this is an example of the interconnected web of relationships through multiple populations in time. That then translates into sort of sets of non-interbreeding isolated populations that were isolated by some species event, perhaps with a little over a million years ago, where we have now the idea of non-interbreeding allopatric species that inside those species are made up of interbreeding individuals. This leads directly to our sort of macroevolutionary tree of several million years of generations with species relationships that are connected one to another, really by the reality of species splitting events in time and extinction events within that phylogenetic tree. And cleverly, then Dave shows in the broad view, everything is connected from him to giraffes to plants and Mimi. So this is really the paradigm for all of phylogenetic analysis today, the great tree of life, and sort of the underlying sort of interconnected genetic element of descent with modification. Well, there's been a long history over the last century, right, of sort of taking this paradigm of trees of life and making it into a more rigorous quantitative science that has an evidence base. And I know this is a full slide, but the big events for us as systematists who make phylogenetic trees really do start with Darwin, move up through sort of the building of an empirical science of natural history information, as well as the growth of empirical and experimental work in development and in all of biology. And it's the new synthesis in the 1930s and 1940s, basically, that began the real integration of population genetics, systematics, and paleontology, where we all felt like we were part of the same evolutionary field. The German dipterist Willy Hennig formalized the theoretical basis for phylogenetic reconstruction. And Hennig was really an incredibly important person in building this paradigm for reconstructing trees of life, because it's Hennig that provided the formalized theoretical basis for understanding what the evidence should be for monophyletic groups, and that groups in nature reflect a real hierarchical pattern because of descent with modification. Zucker, Kandel, and Pauling pointed out that the molecular change was cumulative, and that if we were able to read the biochemical and molecular signal from large macromolecules like proteins and DNA, that as they're passed down through generations, that they would be documents of evolutionary history. And finally, the flourishing of sort of statistical approaches for clustering, and the realization that there's a quantitative expression of Hennig's methodology in the application of parsimony gave rise to the dominance of a very rigorous quantitative phylogenetic field that allowed all of us to become sort of participants in experimental science and having a strong quantitative theoretical background for reconstructing relationships in natural history and diversity. We can't undersell sort of that all of this went on in the last 30 years with the revolution in molecular genetics and revolutions in computation and computational biology. So that has led to what we have now in modern entomology, is trees in all of your textbooks, trees in all of your journals, trees at too many probably for some of you at your seminars. And really, because those phylogenetic trees provide a context for organizing biological variation, the stuff that we're all interested in, they provide the evolutionary comparative framework for understanding it, allowing us to use prediction of traits and interactions and a comparative framework for hypothesis testing. So I'm just going to give you a few examples of how this is done. Sorry about this quick time problem. I'm going to go on. So phylogenetic trees, as you all know, are an important framework for morphological research and for organizing biological variation. And that has not changed as phylogenetics has become more molecular. There are still sort of these kinds of diagrams here showing sort of the presence and absence of character states across a large clade of flies, helping scientists to uncover the homologies and support for monophyletic groups from comparative morphology. You can see these same kind of figures now in genomics journals, linking expression patterns across enormous microarray data gathering procedures. And so this sort of concept for trying to organize and understand the sharing of characteristics is an incredibly important one for modern biology. So this has led to sort of a growth in the kinds of ways that we can incorporate phylogenetic thinking into all kinds of hypothesis testing frameworks, from understanding the origins and adaptations of unique traits across insects, reconstructing ancestral conditions in the history of diversification, and developing statistical methods to sort of try to be more sure about our hypotheses regarding those traits. So I'm going to show a few examples of phylogenetic trees as a context for organizing and understanding biological variation. This is the latest sort of phylogenetic tree from EMBL that unites all of the known genomes, the complete genomes, genome projects. And so this tree is an incredibly important organizing framework for understanding how genes and genomes are related through time, and allowing an enormous amount of comparative genomic research. that translates down into understanding more and more about the origin of biological complexity as we understand the expression patterns of developmental genes and developmental toolkit. We now understand in a phylogenetic framework how genes changed and how that change leads to morphological and biological complexity in a way that Darwin never dreamed. And new findings all the time are challenging our presuppositions about the uniqueness and the variability of patterns in nature. This really interesting paper by Heather Hines, recently published, shows that there are multiple independent origins of a complex behavior, eusociality in Vespid wasps. So we're continually to challenge our assumptions about really important things in behavior, development, ecology, et cetera. Another important use of phylogenetic trees is prediction. And here's an example of how one might predict the origins of an invasive species. Sonia Scheffer, my colleague from USDA Systematic Entomology Lab, published a phylogenetic tree based on mitochondrial data for Liriomyza huidobrensis, an important invasive leaf mining pest that has become a very big pest over the last 100 years in California, really showing that they can track back using genetic relationships and phylogenetic understanding of those introductions, probably to South American introductions into the US. Another example is from my colleague Sheila Morita, who's done really impressive work on a clade of long-tongued tabanid horseflies that are important pollinators of long corolled flowers in western South Africa. And by understanding the phylogenetic relationships within that clade, one can see that long-tongue morphology is correlated with the flowers in specific areas of endemism that they use, and that those correlations occur independently across this phylogeny in two unique clades. She's done work with Stephen Johnson that basically looks at the different ways that you could optimize those long tongues onto phylogeny and try to predict the influence of long tongues on understanding or what influences long tongues from understanding the distribution of the flowers or introducing the flower type. All of these issues are interconnected. So context, prediction, hypothesis testing aren't exclusive, and all of these things are about using phylogenetic trees to understand evolutionary history, really as a framework for taking all of those diverse concepts in the origin and in all of evolutionary biology and being able to visualize them and organize them to test hypotheses. This important work on hypothesis testing is sort of all wound up in this sort of framework we call the comparative method, in which we try to sort of use the phylogeny to control for the effects of phylogenetic history on our assumptions about the adaptations or interactions among organisms or within biologies. This is evidenced in the amazing work of Cillin Tilburg, where her work has sort of looked at the phylogeny of larval behavior, chemical defense, and warning coloration to try to tease apart the parts that influence one another and the correlations that would reveal sort of adaptation of warning coloration and chemical defense. Now, a very simple way to use phylogenetic trees to test hypotheses is that sister groups are equal in age, so they split from a common ancestor at exactly the same time, so that if we count up the extant species in sister group comparisons, those species diversities are a measure of the net diversification rate in those lineages. Really, the speciation versus extinction equals the number of known species now. And so one can compare diversification rates in lineages of equal age, and that's been done quite a bit since my major professor, Charlie Mitter, published an early paper looking at the diversification of Phytophagous insects across many, many clades. And there are many, many papers that have used this method now to try to understand the importance of host shifts in species diversification, the importance of various behavioral adaptations, and the importance of sexual selection, et cetera. It's become a real tool in comparative phylogenetics, And if you're interested in that, I encourage you to look at Brian O'Meara's website, the R-Philo website, where a lot of these methods and the growing sort of statistical rigor with which we can test hypotheses using comparative method are all being developed for use with the open source software, statistical software R. This sort of is sort of what we all would like to be able to do in the diversification rate world, is to test ideas that Darwin was concerned about, right? So Darwin called in his current correspondence his inability to explain the differential diversity of groups that ought to do as well as another, one ought to do as well as another. Sort of being able to explain this incredible differential diversity in groups was his abominable mystery. And here's an example of a phylogenetic tree of the angiosperms, where the colors on these branches are the diversification rate, and the stars are places where independent comparisons of sister group diversities can show sort of speed ups and slow downs in the diversification of angiosperms. So all of this sort of leads me to sort of try to brainwash you to believe, as I do, that assembling phylogenetic trees are an incredibly powerful and important tool in modern biology. They're really critical to a lot of the things that we do in entomology, and that understanding phylogenetic trees is critically important to continuing a more rigorous field, and NSF appreciates that as well. And there has been a very successful program funded by NSF called Assembling the Tree of Life. Really, the idea of this is to fund groups of researchers who can tackle very large problems in phylogenetic reconstruction using all the tools at their disposal in projects that are larger than anyone could ever do in their own lab. And there are a number of insect or arthropod atoll projects, and many of those results of these projects have been displayed at this meeting. I'm lead PI on Flytree, NSF cooperative research program in the atoll project, to try to understand the phylogenetic tree, the tree of life of all flies. And that is a daunting problem, because although we've seen lots of figures of beetles today, flies themselves are amazingly diverse and difficult to understand. A group of insects with incredible and diverse biologies, and even if Darwin didn't love them as much as beetles, we do. And we have been working now quite diligently to collect a number of nuclear genes and mitochondrial genomes and morphology to try to reconstruct a phylogenetic framework for the tree of life of flies. And I'm just showing this to you now because we're close to publication on this first sort of framework tree that shows the reconstruction of phylogenetic relationships across the entire order, recovering groups of flies that make sense to us with respect to comparative morphology. And that project is ongoing. So moving beyond simply 46 species, this large tree moves well off this page as we try to put all fly families sampled for multiple genes into a phylogenetic framework. And this tree will be incredibly important for EvoDevo, developmental biology, neurobiology, all of the Drosophila mosquito community, to begin to do sort of accurate phylogenetic comparisons across the fly tree of life. We've also been very interested in what is the sister group to Diptera. I'm going to take the opportunity today to show you another project within our Tree of Life project. That's really, we would like to understand the phylogenetic tree of holometabolous insects. As you can see from this tree, there's been some uncertainty in the traditional literature about the position of the Hymenoptera and about the position of this weird ectoparasitic group, the Strepsiptera. And sort of early molecular phylogenetic analysis raised the possibility that they could be sister group to the Diptera. That's important to us as dipterists to know that that might be the Diptera's closest relative. And it's interesting that they both have modifications of their wings into halteres. But Coleoptera and Strepsiptera also have modifications of their four wings, both have the behavior of posteromotorism, meaning their hind wings are used for flying. The first sort of big study from comparative genomics was in insects was analyzed 185 nuclear genes, and so a phylogenetic analysis of sort of relatively small taxon sample across the Holometabola found Hymenoptera to be the first branching group in the tree of life for Holometabola. But you can see that Strepsiptera and other insect Holometabolous orders are not here. So we sampled over 30 species from all the orders and six genes and reconstruct this phylogenetic tree using multiple methods in which all of the orders are monophyletic and the Strepsiptera form a sister group to the Coleoptera. Using that same data, we can estimate the divergence times using fossil evidence and hypothesizing rates of evolution for the various genes in this study. We can sort of put all of this tree for the Holometabola into its phylogenetic context with the origin of flies and the origin of the Holometabola within the Permian. So faced with this incredible diversity, we have this paradigm for reconstructing phylogenetic relationships, and the field is vibrant, ongoing, developing new methods, and being challenged every day with the same sort of level of incredible biodiversity that Darwin and Wallace found on their travels. And what this is leading to is an enormous amount of data collection, phylogenetic analysis. This tree is of almost 1,000 species for the Phytophagous beetles, or for the beetles, sorry, and it's from Brian Farrell's lab, Dwayne McKenna in Brian Farrell's lab, and the Beetle Atoll project. So reconstructing phylogenetic trees of this size are an incredible computational problem, but they also present a very difficult visualization problem, where what we need to be able to do, right, is make this tree zoom in and out of it and display it in a way that gives everyone the opportunity to test hypotheses and understand relationships, and they're simply difficult to read. So one of the grand challenges that Nescent that's really being focused on is bringing together computer programmers, phylogeneticists, people who really sort of understand the problem to tackle make new methods for phylogenetic tree visualization. So take all of this sort of large framework for a new emphasis on recovering the tree of all life and making it accessible for tests of hypotheses and research. So I encourage you to go and look at ITOL, the Interactive Tree of Life, put together by Pierre Bork and his associates at EMBL. This is a very, very interesting tree of the established genomes that arrays things like protein structure and genome size and other things like that. And it's an interactive tree, so you can zoom down into it and pull back out and array different aspects of what we know about genomes on that tree. This is a screenshot from the ITOL website, a fun thing to play around with. If you're a phylogeneticist in the audience and you're interested in comparing large trees from your research projects, this program called Tree Juxtaposer, again, is pushing the limits of what we can handle in terms of looking at these trees. And these projects have YouTube videos, so if you can pull yourself away from some of the more fun things on YouTube, take a look at Tree Juxtaposer. And I also want to put a shout out for the understanding phylogenetic trees in both their spatial and temporal context over the biogeography of the planet. David Kidd, who was a postdoc at Nescent and has now moved on, produced a really exciting software package that used ArcGIS to display phylogenetic trees in three dimensions. You can rotate them over the geographic distribution of species and see how that tree has changed through time. It's called GeoPhylo Builder. So finally, I can just summarize by saying Darwin provided the original vision of a tree of life model for the history of descent with modification, and that's become much more than a metaphor for all of us in biology. Modern phylogenetics provides an invaluable context for organization prediction and hypothesis testing. And methodological and empirical expansion of the field of phylogenetics makes tree visualization really one of our grand challenges, in addition to assembling the tree. Thanks.